I will open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing on Monday, March 4th, 2013. Open up an informational hearing on the Early Learning Council. So whomever, come on up. Thank you all for coming today.
I see, Madam Chair, they brought their heavy hitter with
I know,
Mr.
good to
Dick
see you.
No, I mean, so what's the deal with that?
Thanks.
All of them are heavy hitters.
Yeah.
Okay, start however you would like.
Too many notes. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, Duke Shepherd. I'm a policy advisor to Governor Kitzhaber, and I have a team of great people here. Donna Ripley, to my right, who's the Oregon Early Learning System Director, Charles McGee, Lynn Saxton, and Dick Withmell, who are all members of the Early Learning Council. And Dick Withmell has also been nominated by the governor to be the crossover member from the Early Learning Council on the Education Investment Board. So we're here to give you an overview of early learning, and within that, my intent is to go back a little bit, given that we did a lot of work in this committee in the last two sessions, but only two of you were on this committee the last two sessions, so the background will be helpful, and then you can see what the Early Learning Council has been up to and what some of the policy issues might be this session, both in this committee and elsewhere. And to frame this, when the governor ran for election again, he campaigned partly on this idea of reinventing education under this 0-20 framework and having all kids ready for kindergarten, ready to succeed when they get to kindergarten. And particularly when we talk about the need to provide services to the children that are most at risk, a quick way to frame this is we know that in this state, half of all babies are born on Medicaid. That's we have 45,000 babies born a year, roughly, in Oregon. And that we think, and we'll get to this later because we don't know, probably at least 4 out of every 10 are not ready for kindergarten. And we have a huge variety of, this is another way to look at it, of public systems that in many instances touch these children or families in whole or in part, and sometimes together, sometimes not at all. You have the children born, then there's this, we've called this the black hole, it's chaotic, it's churn, where they may or may not be connected to public systems, and then they pop up again at kindergarten because every kid ends up in school. So our real challenge is to go from this birth starting point to the kindergarten starting point and to ensure that children arrive ready for school. And if I could, I'd turn over to the Early Learning Council members to talk about how they got into this and why they care.
Okay, thank you, Duke. Chair Tomei, I'd like to also thank Representative Olson for traveling to Tillamook with me to visit the Oregon Youth Authority. We drove over there on the legal speed limit, and he drove back very, very fast. Almost holding a car on the way back, but didn't quite make it. To be serious here, really, for a moment, I'm a business guy, a local business person, and I'm really interested in two things in this Early Learning Council: the return on investment on dollars and cents, and also the transformation of lives. And I carry in my pocket, I wasn't going to do this, but I'll do this anyway. There was a business article in the Oregonian, and it's when Dick Alexander died. And it said this: the corporate leader waged a successful decade-long effort to expand early childhood programs that admirers say will change tens of thousands of lives and bolster Oregon's economy. What a win-win. Unfortunately, Dick died. But I also carry a little thing in my pocket that when I learned about early childhood development, that 80% of the brain is developed in the first 3 years, you can translate that almost into dog years, right? 1 year is 7, 2 is 14, 3 is 21. Well, we've been, in my language here now, it's going to make everybody nervous here, but we've been messing around with this early learning business. We had a House bill, and Duke is going to talk about it, in 2001. Well, you know, you could say that there's three segments of 3 years, 3 years, and 3 years that have gone by while we're trying to move ahead with this early childhood. I think it's very, very important. I also have my pocket here because about a month ago I had my ear whacked here because of medical problems. But I carry a little Band-Aid around. And this kind of reminds me, too, of maybe what we've been doing here in the last few years, too. So I just encourage us to look at two things here. Dollars and cents saved to the state of Oregon, and also the economic impact on what the Early Learning Council is all about, and you're going to hear more about that. My good friend Charles here will say a couple words. Charles?
Well, Representative Tomei and the committee, thank you all so much for having us today. You know, as Dick spoke so eloquently, I give Dick a hard time.
Could you say who you are, please?
I'm Charles McGee, and I'm a member of the Early Learning Council. I usually give Dick a hard time, not only because he's an older guy, and I like to give older people a hard time. I got him back for you. But, you know, yesterday, actually, my wife and I were at the Walmart in your district. And we saw a probably 12-month-old child who was crying. And he was wailing at sort of the top of his lungs. And his mother just looked at him. And this kid cried for a really, really long time. To the extent that I almost literally went over and grabbed this baby. My wife pulled me back and told me to mind my business. But we got into this conversation when we got home. And my wife started to talk to me. And she said, you know, that mother looked extremely tired. And what if this was her? She's just gotten off work, second or third job, going to get groceries. And she's just tired. And it really started to remind me and bring me to today. And the importance not only of the work that you all do, but truthfully the importance of the work that we all do in our everyday life. And the fierce urgency of now. Because if you think about it, all the research says that it's almost instinctive that a parent would want to pick up a crying baby. But think about what it means for that mother. What must have happened at some point to fight back all that instinct. It speaks to the importance of this work, but it also speaks to the fact that that's another life. I've been a part of this now for almost 2 years, and every single day after a meeting, I leave and I say it just doesn't feel like it's moving fast enough. The last thing I want us to do is to wait another 2 years before we start to see change. But I do realize that some real important questions have to be answered. And I think the Hub Committee, as well as the Early Learning Council, really we've done a lot. And so thank you all for your work and your leadership. And let's get this going.
Thank you, Charles. Thanks for all you've done.
I'm Lynn Saxton, and I'm a member of the Early Learning Council and was part of the team that wrote the Transition Team Report in 2010 to launch this effort. That team was comprised of representatives from the Oregon Community Foundation, experts in early learning, pediatricians, and policymakers and budget analysts. So it's nice to be here today.
Don't say what you're doing.
What I do in my professional life is I'm the executive director of Youth Villages Oregon, formerly known as the Christie School. We serve all 36 counties in Oregon, children and families of seriously emotionally and behaviorally disturbed children. And we serve children either in residential care or in intensive in-home services in their homes with their families.
Thank you, Lynn.
So getting back to the numbers we started out with, the 50% Medicaid, 40% at risk, this, I think we all know this, shows up in third grade reading scores. It shows up throughout the academic progress. We've said many times, that there is pretty linear connection between what we do here and our dropout rate. And there's this used to be sort of instinctive, I think, in policy terms, 10, 20 years ago. Yeah, if you invest earlier, you probably get a better outcome. Now there's academic research, economic research from the Federal Reserve to Harvard to wherever, that the earlier you get in, the better the number's going to be. And the later you wait, the harder it is. So don't let anybody ever characterize this as we're giving up on kids if we don't get to them earlier enough. It just is harder and costs a lot more. So a quick review, that there was a lot of education reform work done last session. I know this is not the education committee, but the work that you do is what is going to lead as much to academic success for kids as the stuff that happens in a particular classroom or setting, especially for early learning, because most of this is about human services, support for children and families that is not, you know, quote, academic. 40-40-20, 100% students would graduate from high school, 40% get a bachelor's degree or higher, 40% earn some post-secondary education. The Oregon Education Investment Board was created, and part early learning, this 0 to 20 spectrum is part of their work, and that legislation also created the Early Learning Council. You heard from some of our members, and the legislation also created Jada Rupley's job as the Early Learning System Director. So I think that's an important point that I'll touch on later, that you now have somebody whose job it is to make all this stuff happen, and that hasn't always been the case. You've had people who had some level of responsibility for parts of it, but nobody who was in charge. And this is the component that Dick talked about that I always like to talk about, because it is both it's a reminder of the things we haven't done and a reminder that we've had the right intentions. So in 2001, in statute, Oregon established an early childhood system. This was noteworthy to me because I spent many months, my first few weeks on the job, hearing from lots of people that we had no system. And then I open up the ORSs and allegedly we do. And there is great stuff in there. This all came out of the Oregon Children's Plan that my boss worked on at the end of his last term. And I'm not asking you to read all this with me. I won't read it to you aloud. That's bad PowerPoint management. But there are key components here, and I think it is consistent with everything that has been talked about by the governor and by the legislature the last 2 years as well. So the real question is why. Well, let me go back. So I have the 8th grade math scores here. We could do whatever 8th grade scores you want. I use this as a note because these kids were babies and infants when the children's plan was passed. We have not moved the dial. And so the children's plan, the way it was constructed, there was no one in charge. So whether it's an agency or an individual, there was nobody whose job it was to get that done. Or to put it another way, there was nobody who would get fired if it didn't get done. There was nobody accountable. There were not outcomes expected. It was lofty goals with expectations for plans and collaboration, but no measurement, no accountability, no connection to dollars, and no expectations that if something didn't work, something would change. And it was really, when you read the statutes, it was the Commission on Children and Families and DHS and the Department of Education would collaborate and try to get things better, but it didn't happen. So at the same time, so Oregon was a bit ahead, actually, in thinking about systems for early childhood. At the same time, the federal government caught up and maybe passed us, because the Head Start Act was reauthorized in 2007 as the Improving Head Start for School Readiness Act. So this drive for school readiness, kindergarten readiness, isn't just an Oregon thing. It is a national realization that that is a target that drives a lot of improvements and change and is the important target. And I will just point you to the bold components here, where it is about system development across all of the funding streams and programs and approaches that we know have across the country and in Oregon. And it requires a state advisory council to oversee this. And so Oregon's response to the act was in 2010 to create another committee, the Early Childhood Matters Advisory Committee, which was by executive order. So it had really great people and did a lot of great work that's actually informed a lot of the policy and legislation that's continued the last 2 years. But because it was created by EO, it really just had advise and report authority. It wasn't, again, it was just another body that wasn't really in charge. And in 2009, Oregon's kindergarten readiness assessment to determine how kids were arriving at school was found to be an invalid tool, so it was discontinued. So since then, we haven't, on a statewide basis, had any consistent determination. This does happen. Districts have taken care of this themselves in a lot of cases and have come up with their own assessments, but this was one of the reasons that we've addressed this in the last 2 years. This is structurally the governance and accountability structure for early learning in Oregon 2 years ago. So you had some components in education, some components that were with the Commission on Children and Family System, which included youth of all ages, and included the commission system delivery model, which was highly flexible but also lacking in consistent outcome expectations back to the state. We have the employment department as the place where our child care division rests. We had then the Early Childhood Matters Advisory Committee. Oh, I forgot. We also had a commission for child care, which did great work, but again, didn't have direct authority to really hold things accountable. And then you have DHS and OHA, which are key pillars of the service delivery, obviously, but weren't included in all this either. So House Bill 4165, which passed through the 2012 version of this committee, aligned and incorporated the Head Start Act into Oregon statute. So that means that these folks to my left are now the Head Start Advisory Council as required under federal law. So we are, and quite intentionally, very wrapped into and connected to the Head Start Act. It is a good framework. It reflects what we've done policy-wise in Oregon with service delivery with around Head Start and OPK. And it just makes things more efficient when you can have one body do the same policy governance that's expected. We last session eliminated the Oregon Commission on Children and Families and the Commission for Child Care and consolidated the key responsibilities from those bodies with the Early Learning Council. So you now have one body that's in charge of making sure the early learning system builds out at the state level. And that legislation sunsetted the 36-county commission system. And then through executive action, the governor repealed the Early Childhood Matters Advisory Council. And we had some good news, a recognition of the work that we've been doing when Oregon received a Race to the Top grant this past fall. We applied a year ago and came in 13th. And one of the critical components in that application was a kindergarten readiness assessment. And we were lucky to come in 13th, I would say, not because we didn't have great ideas, but when the requirement of a grant is to have a kindergarten readiness assessment and you don't have one, that's that could be viewed as a deficiency. And so I would say that if we had one in place, we might have gotten another $20 million because the original grant proposal was $40. We were fortunate because there were other applicants like ours. They only funded 9 in the first round that had high-quality applications that that were high quality enough the federal government decided to open up a second round and fund the next four. So we were surprised and delighted to be asked to accept $20.5 million for Race to the Top, and we've been awarded that and are in the process of implementing it. So I will touch on some of the House Bill 4165 pieces. I just did that. I'll go to a policy discussion that will happen here in education. So aside from the policy and governance board piece, there's the state level, what do the departments look like question. This is a proposed structure. This will be considered in the House Education Committee. And the simple direction here is that the Early Learning Council was set up on an interim basis, floats in the governor's office. You have pieces with the Board of Education right now in the Department of Education, and you have the Child Care Division over in the Employment Department. We would propose consolidating those into one early learning division in the Department of Education. There was consideration given to the question of, do you create an early learning agency? Jada can talk about her experience in the state of Washington. I would just tell you that for reasons of, one, not wanting to grow the government agency count, and also be as efficient as possible and align things toward the common education outcomes that legislation has set up, that a division within this department made the most sense. But that'll be, as I said, there'll be legislation in a couple weeks in the Education Committee.
Do you want to talk about this, John?
Yeah, go ahead and go next. So I'd like to, my name is Jada Rupley, Chair Tomei, committee members. Thank you for having us today. It's very important to start off with early learning at the beginning. And if you look at that first 1,000 days of life, those are critical elements. In many days past, we used to think that kindergarten was the first time that kids were ready to learn. And I think that brain research, as well as other things, show us now, as well as our own children and grandchildren, is that they learn long before they get to kindergarten. So if we look at the connection to healthcare, it's typically not one that is a natural connection between early learning and healthcare providers, and we need to be able to do that because we know that healthy kids and healthy families are going to be able to learn better, feel better, and all of those things that are important. So the strongest beginning for children is going to be at that intersection that they are healthy, that they have been seen by their healthcare provider, as well as an early education program to be sure that whether it's in the home, in a setting, as parents work, or no matter what. So the early learning is that system and that bridge. And if you look at there, we have the giants on one side, which are the healthcare system, and on the other side, we have schools. And on that bridge, we are not alone. We have the Department of Health and Human Services. We have healthcare, we have the county health departments, we have Oregon pre-K programs, we have Head Start. So that bridge is heavy with a lot of people on that bridge. So we have to be able to look at shared goals, metrics to measure those things. And if you have anything, it's the fact that we're going to find kids early, identify them, those that are ready to move forward. We want to get out of the way and let them move forward with their families. Those that may need a little extra help early on, that's what we're able to do. Looking at a universal screening tool to be able to identify that. That might happen both in a healthcare setting. It could also happen at a library. It can happen in a Head Start room. It can happen anywhere kids and families are. With that early intervention, we also look at how we refer and that we coordinate those systems so that we don't have six different early learning systems that are all serving the same child if that's not indeed needed, because that way we don't have kids that are aging out on waiting lists. And think about that. Young children that would sit on a waiting list so long that they would become old enough that they're no longer eligible for the program is not what we want in the state of Oregon. And then also to be able to plan and make sure that happens, because as you see, in 2001 we had a good plan, but in order to do that we have to be intentional.
Can I make a comment? Can you put that?
To the bridge?
Yeah. If I had a laser pointer, I'd you'd be looking at if you could. I'm on the Higher Education and Workforce Development Committee as well, and the way I look at it is, you know, if we just had another building over there to the right, you know, higher education, clearly to me it really is a matter of starting healthcare early on. I would say even with Head Start, with, you know, healthy mothers and so on, and all the way through to a workforce development. I mean, it's just the total picture.
You know,
I appreciate that a lot.
I actually like that higher education for two reasons. One is the workforce development, because if we could have jobs for all those families, then we wouldn't need those supports.
Exactly.
They could do that themselves.
Okay.
The second piece is that the training in the higher education institutions is really important to the providers that are providing these quality learning environments. So we need them too.
Great. Thank you.
Again, Duke Shepherd, back on here. One thing that was teed up in the legislation is a new delivery system, and it's actually was teed up in the transition report, and Lynn will talk about it, because I think it's important to sort of map back to how substantially the thinking and the approaches have evolved here. But the old system, and by this I'll just say the commission system, because fairly, and in some places not fairly, that's the proxy for a system, because it was at least worded that way a lot in statute, although their ability or an authority was very limited too, I would say. But the approach that we've talked about is different in that the commission system, local counties got formula allocations, and their responsibility to the state was to produce a plan. And that's a deliverable, and sometimes those plans produced outcomes and sometimes they didn't. I think it's highly variable because commissions turn over, county commissioners turn over, priorities change. And when there's not a rigorous adherence to the key outcomes that the state wants, the state's really ended up paying for a plan. when you look at the total, and I exclude Healthy Start and Relief Nurseries because while they pass through commissions, they're really their own programs that are very well clearly defined. The flexible dollars in the last biennium, including services to older youth, are about $17 million. And 9.6 of that is basic capacity, which is staffing, but it's not direct service staffing. So right off the bat, the state's previous structure funded staffing and plans and not outcomes. And I would contrast that with Head Start, which has a 15% admin limit. Community action agencies are basically capitalized starting off. Their base funding is $5 million, and they're all over the state fighting poverty. And then I warned Representative Kindergeyer, I would say this, Mercy Corps has a 12% overhead, and they are in war-torn, poverty-stricken countries doing the hardest work humans could possibly do. And I will turn over...
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Hey, Duke, can we go back two slides? Because you went through that one really quick, and it's, let's see, one more. There you go, right. There you go. The community-based coordinators are really the hubs.
Yep.
So I guess, you know, you might, maybe I'm being out front on this one, and maybe you're going to already address it, I don't know. I get the discussion that I guess right now is happening in the legislature with that whole issue. How involved are the counties going to be involved in this, or are they going to have any control, or... Because I know that that's getting floated out there right now.
So, Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, I'll answer those questions and go, I think, to the larger discussion you want us to have. So, the House Bill 4165, which was passed last session, requires counties to be consulted and have a degree of sign-off on any community-based coordinator of early learning services. Now, if we proceed down that route as envisioned in that legislation, counties have a key role required in statute. I think functionally, both in terms of public health and in other services, it's not going to succeed if they're not at the table. And in fact, the county supported the legislation last session.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
So, Lynn, do you want to talk about where we started?
Okay. Let's talk about where we started. We started this process looking at what it takes to make 40-40-20 successful. In other words, how many kids do we need to get to every year, pre-birth to five, to get enough kids into kindergarten successfully to start to attain the 40-40-20 goals? And so we kind of started from the math. And then we looked at the money. And so what we came up with was, and I think the number here is very telling, we couldn't 2 years ago, we couldn't track it as clearly in the budget, but what we came up with was somewhere between 35 and 45 cents of every dollar was going to overhead, as opposed to getting to the children who needed the services. And the children who need the services on an annual basis in Oregon, pre-birth to five, are somewhere between 102 and 108,000 children. And we had both the transition committee and what was called the design committee looked at those numbers in depth, and we can have a robust discussion of whether it's 102 or 108. One of my concerns is it may be more as a result of the continuing impacts of the recession, particularly in rural Oregon, where we see more of those families. I live part of my life in Klamath Falls, where we see some real economic fallout. So we started with that. How many kids need to get this service? Then we started with how much money is there? And then what we said is there's all these great services, all these great providers, lots of people doing good work. It's just not integrated to an outcome. And how could we do that? And how could we do it in a way that would not be prescriptive and would be efficient and to get that overhead down so that more money goes into serving more kids? Because what we learned is, even with the increases in the budgets for the early learning and for some of the other providers in this continuum, if we don't do something to change the metrics, we never get enough kids through the system to attain 40-40-20. So we came up with the notion of hubs, and we used that term loosely at the start because we thought hubs could be anything. Hubs could be a county government. Hubs could be a CCO. Hubs could be a commission on children and family that reinvents itself and deploys the resources to an outcome at a certain level of investment. And we wanted to be, I know we've all heard a lot about the tight-loose concept, But we didn't want to be prescriptive, and we didn't want a system that was heavy at the top and light at the bottom. And we actually began to look at models in other states. Around the country, we looked at a very effective model that's been used in Alaska, which has a very distributed Eskimo and Native Alaskan population in villages where you can only get to once a year. We looked at their systems for having broad impact on populations in need with light administrative structure. So that work took over the course of 2 years, lots of good ideas, lots of failed ideas, and what we did is came forward with a proposal for hubs that incorporates the best of what we've learned, but also does it from the standpoint of optimal creativity for local government. So, for example, we're starting to see proposals in Multnomah County, Deschutes County, I'm sure we're seeing some from Eastern Oregon, that they're different. They're tailored to what's on the ground there. They're tailored to what the infrastructure is there and to what the community assets are. And from our perspective, as we began this design process, we didn't say it has to be this way. We said the state's investment needs to produce this outcome. And so that's the basis and the core of our work. And we think there's lots of ways to get from A to B, and we think there's lots of smart people about how to get from A to B. But the part that's most critical is if we don't increase the number of children served, even if we keep putting money in, if we don't increase the number of children served and restructure how we're doing this, we don't ever get to have an impact on the higher ed end of the continuum where we want these kids and their families to be. One other thing I'd just add, which is a small piece but a critical piece. In the beginning of this work and throughout this work, we have put the family front and center because the world has changed dramatically in the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And one of the things that's changed is the research shows that families who get what they need in an integrated, coherent way driven towards the appropriate outcomes can be highly successful in getting their children into kindergarten successfully for the rest of their education. And no surprise to any of us who've been working with families in poverty for years, many families in poverty, given the right amount of support, can also be successful in that regard. But right now, the support comes in a variety of ways to a variety of families, and at the end of the day, doesn't get to enough families to make the difference that we're hoping to make with this initiative.
Thank you, Lynn.
I'll keep, for the record again, Duke Shepherd, so I'll just keep rolling here.
Yeah,
so,
do we have problems with the...
Oh, it's okay.
Did I do that?
I didn't.
I want to reemphasize what the slides are meant here to illustrate is there was a concept early on about a new regionalized delivery system that was a little more rigid. It was five regions, it was global budgets, it was a lot of the CCO kind of model. And then as we learned from the legislative process, from community input, from the CCO process, which provides a lot of similarities but not quite the same thing, is that the concept here is that the Early Learning Council, the state, would let an RFP that communities can organize themselves about responding to how they're going to get kids ready for kindergarten across service systems. So this means not just not just the traditional sort of early learning universe, but it means healthcare, it means the school district, it means having everybody at the table to come up with a solution and being the state being rigorous about kindergarten readiness and the outcomes that lead to kindergarten readiness. So, and this partly answers Representative Olson's question. So Section 77 of Oregon Law, Chapter 37, 2012, which is what House Bill 4165 ended up being, lists all the criteria currently in statute for a community-based coordinator of early learning services, which the shorthand has become hubs, but that's not what's in the statute. It's community-based coordinators of early learning services. And there's a work group Charles chaired it. Dick and Lynn both served on it. A number of others, individuals from around the state who were not on the Early Learning Council. We had a couple executive directors from commissions on children and families, Head Start a director, others that helped further refine and produce that report. And if you don't have it, we can get it to you, but it is also online. So here are the outcomes that I think the Early Learning Council and the legislature should look to that lead to kindergarten readiness. So the big one is obviously kindergarten readiness, but these are the ones, and this is nothing new. We didn't come up with this. This is what you do in early learning programs. This is what you're measuring. This is how you're trying to help a child develop. And these are the kinds of system outcomes that we've looked at for determining whether the system is working as efficiently to the big macro outcomes that we want for both the state budget and state policy. Dick, you and Charles, you want to talk about this?
You know, one of the things that we spoke, that we talked a lot about during the committee was really focus. And I think as you start to sort of see this come out, there was a clear sort of reality that there's not a lot of money, and the issues in our state are deep and wide. And focus and being intentional and being extremely purposeful. So whether you go to the first report or you go to sort of this report, you will see really clearly spelled out children in need, children in poverty, and how the hubs are formed, and being clear that hubs need to be somewhat organic and community driven, because, you know, I'm a Portland guy. What do I look like telling Harney County how to deliver service?
I have a question, if I understand this correctly. How are we going to judge outcomes from different systems? If you're saying that the hubs are going to be whatever the hub in that region is, if you go back at slide, how do you judge social or emotional outcome or family support or, you know, I mean, these are so broad that it just seems like we're biting off something that we don't have an endpoint that we can measure against.
Right. So I think that's the key question, Representative Whitsett. And I think we can look at, that's where the world has changed. There's a big difference between process outcomes and child-level outcomes. So we didn't used to have the ability to track how children are doing. So we serve kids, we spend money, and we hope it all produces the right volume of result that we need as a state to move forward. In today's world, we can look at child-level outcomes. We can look at, we can track through, many states are doing this right now, through identifiers, we can know that a family that comes through five doors to get support services of some kind, we can look at, is that family first getting everything they need, and second of all, are they getting too much of what they need because there's a lot of duplication or lack of integration, and we can find out if the child, for example, at birth, we have one measure we can do at birth, we have a number of measures in between there that are simple. There are tools used across the country right now as best practice tools, and by tracking those indicators, you can predict success for a child and family. And that's a fundamental shift here in focus, which is to say we can invest in a lot of programs that will provide a lot of services, and that's great. And that's what we're doing. We're doing that right now, the Relief Nursery, the Earl Boyles program. We can look at any number of programs and say that program does a great job. It serves 5,000 children and families. It produces this level. But can we track them to the outcome? And the answer is we can. There are systems doing it all over the country today. And what that can tell you is if, because part of our challenge here is to do just enough as opposed to everything and hope it works out. Let's do just enough, but let's get to a whole lot more kids than we're getting to right now because we're just not doing that job. But let's get clear on if we do these things, these results will happen. We can measure those results. Dick Alexander had done a lot of work on that before he passed away. They're doing it in other states. We can do it here. But the critical thing is you're looking at client-level outcomes, family-level outcomes, not process-level outcomes at a program level. It's a critical distinction. It's one best practice distinction that is made across the country today in terms of shifting social service systems to purchasing results as opposed to purchasing process.
So, Lynn, you're talking about there's a tool to measure this. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. There's a number in each of these domains. There's five domains there. In each of those domains, there are tools that can be used to assess appropriate progress at appropriate age. And a number of providers in the state are already doing this work. So they will say, for example, there are certain things that indicate that child motor development is happening at the right age, and so there would be a check on that. Okay, I'm a nonprofit serving a group of kids in Klamath Falls. I can measure that of the kids we serve, 80% with the right level of support are demonstrating appropriate child motor skills at the appropriate age, or 30% aren't, and we've got to dive down and get those addressed so that they can move forward. But there are professional measures for each of those that you can use, and there's some professional discretion there, I think, in terms of who likes to use what measure.
Is that sufficient for you for the time?
And Madam Chair, Representative Whitsitt, I would just add, for example, these are things that Head Start tracks. These are things that Relief Nurseries track. You're settling on what the right tool is to be used across multiple programs and systems, and how to. We do have the elephant in the room here, and is the data. The data management is a huge problem that we have to tackle.
And how would you go about tackling that?
Well, part of it is getting to Chair Tomei. Part of it's an IT question. And I'm not great at the IT questions, but I would say one thing that we do know is we have a ton of information, and we need that information to talk between systems better than we do now. So it's really the state prioritizing, and I think it's changing the state's approach. So instead of saying we have a data question, let's build a database, it's we have data, let's use it better. And that's really the challenge, and then connecting that data up to the education outcomes we want.
Please do. Just to give an example of how that work can be done, probably 8 years ago now in Multnomah County, with a Robert Woods Johnson grant, we were implementing a series of wraparound initiatives with families to integrate care to a result. And we developed a data system that gave us client-level outcomes, multiple points of access for all the social service providers in Multnomah County, as well as the government partners, where we could, every partner could look at the data at the child and family level. And so we created our own tool. So those kinds of things can be done. There's a lot of work going on at University of Washington right now to create those tools, and we envision such a tool being available. We actually have the inverse problem right now. We have way too much information non-integrated, and what we need is the integrative piece to really produce the outcomes.
And I would hope at some later date, I mean, much later in this session, that you could come back with us and tell us about those tools and how you measure it, et cetera. That would be great. Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. It's an evaluation question as well. I'm just curious. I know that Head Start, as a federal program, has quite extensive evaluation requirements, and they're quite costly. And yet, you know, here you're describing a number of different programs that are intersecting. How are you sort of managing the different evaluations, or is there one way to, do you have a total evaluation system? And then the second part of that is like I said, I know that that's, our Head Start's quite costly evaluation. Is there a way to sort of efficiently sort of develop a system that you're using efficiently?
So, Chair Tomei, Representative Gallegos, one thing that we're very conscious of is not creating new burdens, because the reason we have all this data that we don't use well is because everybody has to produce it. And so Head Start is held to very high standards, very rigorous federal standards, and then there are a variety of other standards for other programs. We want to be able to, part of the concept for the hubs is, if you have, and I have a slide on this later, if you have a kindergarten readiness assessment, you have the community come together and say, okay, what are we doing to get kids ready for kindergarten? Head Start comes in and raises their hand and says, here's our numbers. Relief Nursery comes in and says, here's our numbers. And these are all public, this is all public info, so here's our numbers. And you can begin to assess the collective impact or lack thereof by having this kind of collaboration, but without saying, Head Start, you have to enter all these 128 different standards, and now here's seven more. We don't want to add the seven more.
Great. Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought you asked the right question specifically about that one program. How are you going to do this? I guess my additional question, which could wait for your suggestion of them coming back, at what cost? Because there's a lot of great information. There's a huge list here. My colleague to my left here touched on it. Efficiencies are important, but how much will this cost to corral that kind of information and apply it? Not a question to answer today, but I hope we can get back to it.
Good question.
Okay. So I will skip it. I will say these are just these system outcomes. These are examples that could be different, or things that are measured in various spots now already. And so I would give you already referenced relief nurseries. They measure the increase in frequency of adult reading, of the adult in the house reading to the child. And then we really care as a state, obviously, for policy reasons and matters of finance. Reducing foster care is a huge saver of kids and families and money. And then quickly, I know we're chewing up your time.
Representative
Wisnett.
Couldn't I say that? Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's tough with the two of us. If anyone else here has been on Ways and Means. Mr. Shepherd, on Ways and Means, we look at performance measurements. Go back to these systems outlook. The first half of those are not really outcomes. That's participation rates, and that's not.
You're right. You're right. They're system measures. So I should have said measures, but they are useful.
Okay. Very good.
Duke, let me interject. The favorite most nines. Initials in the state of Oregon is DOC, OIA, and DHS. And what Duke is outlining here is going to affect every one of those. And there's a behavioral economics ROI on that if we do it right.
ROI?
Yeah, ROI. Return on investment.
Thank you. We try to talk with words, not words.
It's ROI to me. It's an internal investment.
Thank you.
So to finish up on this hub conversation, this new delivery model, at least as contemplated based on previous legislation and the governor's budget, recognizing that there's a legislative conversation to be had about what this looks like, at least the present thinking on it is that the money that would flow through hubs is basically the funds that used to go through the commission system, and everything else would be connected to it. So if Ian artfully said, if you cash a state check, you're part of the team, you got to be there, and you're going to be evaluated on being there. But this is not a matter of pooling everybody's resources and sort of flooding it out in some sort of block grant process. That's not it at all. And the governor's budget reflected that. Each early learning line item in the, here received an increase. And so that was intentional, but with the thought that it's all got to be coordinated together toward the outcomes that we want. I will go quickly through the kindergarten readiness assessment I mentioned. We previously had one. It was found invalid. House Bill 4165 established a process for the Early Learning Council and Department of Education to pilot a kindergarten readiness assessment this past fall and roll it out statewide fall of 2013. This is the utility of a kindergarten readiness assessment. It is not a test. It is not you show up and you are not ready for kindergarten, you go home. It is not you show up, you are really ready for kindergarten, you advance. It is where is the child? How does the instructor use that to inform the education of the child? How do we use that as a state to measure our system's progress, our educational system progress toward third grade reading? And very importantly, how does that then create a feedback loop to early childhood providers about how and a community about how we're preparing kids and about how we're interacting with children and families across multiple publicly funded systems? And I use this example a lot, that since this work has started, I can't quite count the number of times, rural, urban, suburban settings, where I've been in a room with preschool teachers, early childhood educators, kindergarten teachers, and they say, this is great what the state's doing. We've never all talked to each other before. That's a low bar, but it shows that the amount of progress that can be made when we are intentional about this in a way that we just have not been as a state. And this is the way the kindergarten readiness assessment could theoretically interact with this hub process. And I think it's important. There's a reason to have an organized delivery system model of some kind in communities, because once this kindergarten readiness assessment starts, you will have the full weight of the K-12 system looking behind them at some point saying, okay, you keep asking us to meet the third grade reading benchmark, and kids aren't showing up for kindergarten. This isn't our fault. What are you going to do about it? And we need to have a what are you going to do about it. It's not just, well, my program's great, but it's those guys. It's got to be, what are we as a community, with the schools, with CCOs, with healthcare, with human services, going to do about it? And you create this delivery model, whether it's hubs or something else, and you have an annual kindergarten readiness assessment to see, are you making progress with kids over time? Oh, sorry, I'm going backwards. And then I will turn this over to Jada for the tiered quality rating and improvement system.
Chair Tomei, committee members. The tiered quality rating, I can't say it all, so we're just going to call it a quality rating and improvement system, is a national movement that we have access to now with the Race to the Top funds. It was an idea that was in the plan, but it's got common elements, standards, process for monitoring those standards, and provider support and incentives. So I want you to think about families. This could be one of the most important decisions that they make, is where are my children going to be in a child care setting, whether it's a licensed child care setting in a home or in a center, or if it's a neighbor down the street. And the reality is that, how did they decide that? It's like, okay, I've heard from someone down the street, maybe one my sister told me or whatever. There is no common way for them to look at that. So what parents will see out of the quality rating and improvement system is a rating system that they'll know that we have quality learning environments at this home, standards and those kinds of things, easily understandable. So think about hotel ratings, stars, restaurants, when you make choices to do that. They'll have the same kind of criteria to be able to look at doing that. If I'm a provider and I volunteer to be a part of the quality rating and improvement, I know that I'm going to have support. I'll have coaching. I will have resources and training available to me to be able to provide the best possible environment to be able to work with children of all those ages. And I think that you also may not hear about it, but it's a system similar to the K-12 system in terms of, if we look at how teachers get better at what they do, we give them the training and the opportunity. So those are the kinds of things that we're going to do. And then finally, when we look at most of the children under the age of 3 are at home with their parents. So what kinds of things can we do to help them? Or what happens if I'm grandma and I may have raised my children differently than what we want to make sure to be able to do? So maybe there's a way that I have some tips as a grandma. I can go to the library. I can take some social environment kinds of things where my grandchild can be with other kids in a play group, in a reading group, or whatever kinds of things in terms of that early literacy moment. So all of those things will be designed by the resource and referrals, as well as you're already to kindergarten assessment again? Okay. And so we have a field study started January, and it's happening in Crook, Deschutes, Jefferson Lane, Douglas County. And so some of those are very important, because these are also probably some of our early adopters looking at some of the hub work. So they're already moving forward. We have resource and referral who have what they call quality improvement specialists, which are coaches who will go in and out of those homes to be able to look at that. And then finally, they're going to look at recruiting some of those training kinds of things in February and March.
If my next year you're talking about.
This year.
Yes.
They
already
started.
They've already started.
Yes. Part of the Race to the Top grant.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, just to close the quality part out, that this is half of the Race to the Top funds that we have. So this is a big, this quality movement, and I should also point out, this is for licensed settings. So we are having very great conversations with so-called friends, family, and neighbor providers about how to create quality improvement opportunities in those settings as well. But this TQRS is focused on licensed care settings right now. And finally, we have produced a ton of reports. And I will just add all at the as a result of, all these are basically as a result of legislation. So they're on the OEIB website under Early Learning. I'm happy to email them directly to you if any of you want them or the link. And I think moving forward, we've got the kindergarten readiness piece. We've got a joint health policy board, early learning council work group, trying to identify some shared metrics and build that, kind of weave the healthcare and early learning pieces together in a way that, that's going to be the most thoughtful. Whatever this new delivery system looks like coming out of this session, the 2013 legislation on the creating the division, we've got Race to the Top and this TQRS. And this is the Early Learning Council. The people who have names that I made in green, they fulfill specific slot requirements for the Head Start Act. So there, you must have, for example, someone from the Oregon Health Authority. You must have some, at least one person from a Head Start. We have multiple Head Start connections here. This is a really great group of leaders that bring a lot of diversity of thought and experience, and have been very responsive, I think, to the directions of the legislature and the governor, and I think will continue to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're still here. And with that, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you. I was just wondering if I heard properly, you were talking about coaches going in and out of homes. So for what age would that be? And it, would this be a requirement for families with children in state-funded daycare or programs? Or could you elaborate more on the coaches going in and out of private homes?
So Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, I think, John, I misspoke, because the TQRS is about centers. So it, to the extent that a center might be a licensed setting as a home, that's the, where the coaching might be. And that is, again, this is all voluntary. So if a provider wants to move up the quality rating and improvement system, and by having a visit that demonstrates what the health and safety standards are, what the curriculum they're using, and that and the coach can come in and say, and if you got this training, you could go from a 3-star to a 4-star. It's that kind of voluntary interaction with somebody to help them improve their care.
So it's not private homes, and it's something else.
If they're a licensed child care provider, that's the only circumstance.
Thank you. And would they be invited or required to have this?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the TQRS is a voluntary. The idea is to create, this is about incentives. So this is providers, once you reach, licensing is the base threshold. So if you're a licensed provider, you may say, you know what, I'm going to put up some lawn signs and my child care quality speaks for itself and word of mouth works for me.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can say, I want to embark on this path of professional development and improvements in my care so that I can be a 3-star system, and that when somebody looks for child care through the resource and referral network and they decide they want a 3-star, they're going to come to me. Purely voluntary.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Lisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment, about 10 years ago, the Commission on, State Commission on Children and Families were working on daycare quality. The problem, even in Deschutes County, especially South Deschutes County, we don't have daycare. We had one outside of Sun River, and it just closed. We don't have daycare. Not quality daycare, we don't have daycare. And it's a real problem. We just had one that went under because they lost their Head Start instructor, and that that was paying the weight to the other people who are coming in there. So in central rural Oregon, you're going to have a problem just having daycare, which is a need, especially in our society today. Thank you.
Any further questions?
Well, Madam Chair, how much more time do we have for this? Because obviously it's
we
a
have
big,
as much
broad
time as we
question.
Need.
Okay, we have one more. So you were saying that the Race to the Top funding, which is $20 million, half of that would go to the TQRIS for licensed daycare. Can you talk about how much of that might be quality dollars versus parent subsidy dollars? I don't know if I'm getting too much in the weeds in this, but I'm just, I've been in previous conversations, I want to know where it is, and where the other $10 million is going, and in terms of the quality versus subsidy, where you are with family, friend, and neighbor. If you could just update us on some of those recent discussions.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kinnegar, I'll also ask Kara Waddell to come up. She actually knows everything about TQRS.
Mm-hmm.
So she can talk about that and what the components of the grant are, and then it's a little bit separate from the components of the budget around subsidy versus and quality, just because those happen independent of the grant.
Great. I'm Representative Tomei and, of course, Representative Kenny Geyer. The quality rating and improvement system, as mentioned, is roughly half of the grant. We'd be glad to provide for the committee an overview of the different pieces and where that goes. Beyond the breakout.
Could you identify yourself, please?
I apologize. My name is Kara Waddell. I serve on the Early Learning Council, and I'm the administrator of the Child Care Division, which is the lead agency for the Child Care and Development Funds.
Thank you.
Great. Tier quality rating and improvement system is designed for licensed care. That in no way takes away from the critical need in our state for the quality improvement of what's traditionally called family, friends, and neighbor care or informal care. So when a child is not in parental care, they're usually in either an informal care setting, a neighbor, or an aunt. And traditionally, that can even be overrepresentative with our at-risk populations. So it's important that we continue to look at investments for that. The terms of the Race to the Top grant did not provide a great deal of supports for those family, friends, and neighbor care. So we are continuing to look at that. Discussions currently, would you like me to discuss through portions of it? We have, working with our SEIU, which represents subsidized family, friends, and neighbor care in the state, we did contract with Oregon State University, who did a literature review of a variety of evidence-based programs for the quality improvement of family, friends, and neighbor, and we're in discussions to identify which of those would be appropriate in that setting. We allocated a small amount of money in 13-15 and are currently spending in excess of $3 million on the quality improvement of family, friends, and neighbor care through the resource and referral system, as well as direct investment.
Representative Wisnett, you had another question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For the committee's information and our great panel here, if they could confirm this, one of the things we were concerned about was transition plan and no gaps being, as we have a hand over here, and Director Ripley just told me that they're going out and getting a list of all the current programs under this Early Learning Center to look at them and see which they want to continue and take care of that. So I feel a lot more comfortable about that, that there will be a transition plan and no gaps. And we're trying to do that in the Youth Development Council, too, and looking. That's one of the things you tasked David and I to do. So we're looking to be sure there's a transition plan and no gaps in services. So.
Terrific. Thank you.
Chair Tomei, may I respond to the remainder of Representative Kenny Geyer's question? So the other components beyond TQRS of the Race to the Top grant, there were components around kindergarten readiness, parent engagement, common universal screening. So really supporting a lot of the pieces we've had in statute for some time, there were components of that grant. And it's as Kara mentioned, the TQRS was if you saw the slides and you saw Race to the Top TQRS, that's the Oregon TQRS because they set the terms and we applied for it.
I have a series of questions that have come from the counties, and I said we'd take all the time we need. On the other hand, we do have another hearing. So I'm going to tell you what they are, and then you can either, if you can give me a quick answer, that would be great. If not, then maybe I'll invite you to come back. What would be the timeline for the hub development? And part of that question, if funding for the commissions is not available from July 1st of this year to December of this year, how will planning and development of hubs continue, and what will happen to those families currently being served?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I would once again point out that the Association of Oregon Counties supported the entirety of House Bill 4165 last time, so they helped set up this process, and a lot of good people have put a lot of thinking into it. The statute as it reads now requires these community-based coordinators of early learning services to be up and operational by January 1, 2014. Now, anything different than that will require some legislation. There is legislation both introduced by the governor and a number of members of both chambers that would allow for changes. So I think we're looking at how to best accommodate an appropriate rollout of a new system. And so I would say right now I don't think it's going to be January 1, 2014. That's just what's in statute now. In terms of who does the planning, I think we have a difference of opinion on whether or not planning can happen without commission executive directors. I think it can, so does the governor. There are lots of really smart people in lots of communities who are doing this, and many of them actually are commission directors right now. Some of the best thinking has come out of commission directors who know that their position won't be funded by the state anymore, but they're working it out. So in terms of the transition, as Representative Wisnett pointed to, JADA has produced a draft transition plan. I don't think it's as hard as we kind of want to make it. I think if the state is funding vital services through a county now, you don't need a commission to continue that contract. Counties have procurement departments. Counties manage contracts all the time. If you want to run a contract through a county, you can run it through a county and transfer whatever you want to a new entity whenever you want to. It's really the policy conversation is about the timing and the phasing of any changes. So if you continue to contract through through December 30th, 2014, and a hub in a given community was up January 1, 2014, presumably part of the response to the RFP would be a transition component because the counties are required to be part of any hub. So you can't even start a hub without having the county sign off, which means the people that are operating the program are going to be at the table determining how to transition it. So it doesn't mean it's easy, but it does mean that it's solvable and things are set up now in a perhaps too quick and a little clunky way. But I think if we're clear about what the time frames are going to be, that the good people at the counties and other programs can figure out how to make those transitions work in the best way possible.
Great, thank you.
I have a question related to, I think, what she just asked. So federal money is coming into the county through Head Start. Are you going to keep Head Start as an individual program in that county or hub then? This is a question that I've been asked.
Sure. Right. Chair Tomei, Representative Witsit, there are no changes contemplated to Head Start under any circumstance other than to be a participant in the collaborative conversation. So however the federal money flows now, that's up to the federal government. And the state has chosen to match its general fund dollars to those Head Start investments, and we have not proposed nor do we anticipate changing those.
Which funding streams will be funneled through hubs? Healthy Start, Healthy Families, Relief Nurseries, will that funding be funneled through the hub?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I don't think that's necessary. I think what's necessary is to have the folks who run those programs as a participant in the hub and collaborating toward those outcomes. If the legislature chose to do it that way, that's certainly possible.
And is there a minimum number of children who need to be served in order for some entity to be a hub?
Chair Tomei, the requirements in statute are that there's not a minimum number of children. It is cover all the kids and make sure that there's not a corner of the state that's left uncovered. And we have clearly the target populations, and there's an at-risk population definition in statute. So let's look at, we'll just say that 40% of kids who are at some level of risk, that's who we want to cover.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. I have two questions. One is, have counties gotten approached you about regionalizing, coalescing in their early conversations about wanting to become a hub? That's one question. And the other is the whole data piece, the development of your data system to be able to track kids from program to program. Could you say something about where both those are?
Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer. So yes, we've had counties that are interested in consolidating. I think when we talk about one difference in an old system versus this current one, it's not pre-naming a unit of government as the appropriate place. So in some places it's an ESD, some places it could be a nonprofit. But whether it's the geographies or the units of government, there's talk in a variety of communities about regionalizing. Not huge regions, I would say, at this point, but perhaps geographically bigger on the east side of the mountains. And then the data question is just, it's the one that it feels like, I shouldn't say this on record. It feels like we have the same conversation over and over, and I'm not. We're working to try to bump that. I think Dr. Crew is working particularly hard on it, and the governor is very focused on it. Really, I think we've looked at the amount of data investment that's been made in DHS and OHA, for example, that's the place to start, and that that we can probably more cost-effectively figure out how to use that data and connect it to what we want toward education outcomes than creating something new.
I would just add to the data discussion that we have examples where local governments, local hubs may pick up the data piece, and because of their agility and the fact that they're kind of self-defined, they may be able to pick it up and initiate it and run it while the state figures out how it's going to do it. I think there's a real opportunity here to advance to where we are in the rest of the world right now in terms of creating data systems that are agile, regional, and not labyrinthine. They have to be able to connect to ODE and to Dr. Crew's goals for education, but there are some options that I think we can look at.
So, thank you. And I know there's a tension between wanting to have local control and innovation versus wanting later to compare apples to apples if you want to judge outcomes, you know, for hubs versus hubs. So,
and I think the example I would give there, and there are some good examples right now in the state since 2006 in the mental health system, we're in 36 counties. We're preparing my organization to work with 15 CCOs. We have a core of data that we have to maintain for our own quality standards, but we have been able to produce what each county wants and to configure the data in an efficient and effective mm-hmm. way so that you can get the job done for the local community, the mm-hmm. job done that we need done, and then, of course, the job that Medicaid and all the regulators need done. So mm-hmm. I think there are some examples now in Oregon being used that show a pathway for doing that.
Colleagues, I think this is one of the most important things that's going to be happening this session. I'm very excited about it, but it is very difficult. We appreciate all the work you've done on this, and Charles, whoever it is. And we're going to be inviting you to come back to bring this up to date, and we're going to be generating more questions, I know, that we'll be sending to you. We'll try to get them to you ahead of time if possible. So thank you very much for coming for all the
thank
work you.
You
do. With that, we will close the informational hearing on the Early Learning Council.
Oh, she wanted you. She wanted
okay. And open
sorry.
Up the public hearing on House Bill 2095.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2095 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. It modifies the definition of former foster child to reflect federal standard for higher education grants, tuition waivers, and scholarship purposes.
Great. Thank you very much. So we have Peggy Cooksey and Reagan. Great. Reagan, where is she? There she is. Good to see you.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Gomberg. I guess Vice Chair Olson has left the room and committee. My name is Peggy Cooksey, and I'm with the Oregon Student Access Commission. I'm here to testify regarding House Bill 2095, and I thank you for the opportunity. I was informed to give you a little bit of information about our agency. I will keep it short and sweet. We basically do financial aid programs and college access, including the Oregon Opportunity Grant, the Chafee Education and Training Grant, which I work with for former foster youth. We have over 450 privately funded scholarships, and we are the home for the Aspire program, which is a mentoring program for high school, and we're working down into the middle school age youth now. Each year, we have approximately $700,000 dispersed for former foster youth for the Chafee Education and Training Grant. In the previous legislative session, House Bill 3471 created the tuition and fee waiver program for former foster youth. And House Bill 2095 basically aligns the language for the eligibility for foster youth with the existing federal Chafee Education and Training Grant. In 3471, the original eligibility was that a foster youth had to have spent 1 year in substitute care after the age of 16. The Chaffee Education and Training Grant requires that a foster youth be in care for a minimum of 6 months or 180 days after the age of 14 and not dismissed or adopted from care before the age of 16. House Bill 3471 also did not recognize tribal substitute care. House Bill 2095 brings that language into play also so that the those that are in tribal care are given the same consideration for tuition and fee waiver. So the overall effect is that it aligns the two programs. It's positive in that it doesn't leave a handful of students, perhaps 40, 50 a year, out of being eligible for both programs. There's very little impact financially simply because the majority of our students are going to community colleges that are receiving the tuition and fee waiver or Chaffee, and the way the program is set up, their federal Pell Grant and the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which we at OSAC prioritize for these youth, are applied first. And after you apply those to their tuition and fees, there's a very small dollar amount that may be waived under the program. I think that probably the best part of passing 2095 in the long run will be that it will erase confusion between who would be eligible for one but not eligible for the other, and it provides continuity.
Great, thank you.
Hi, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Reagan Gray, and I submitted written testimony for Pamela Butler, who is the Child Welfare Policy Manager at Children First for Oregon, and she was unable to be here today, so I'm just going to make some comments on her behalf. Children First supports this aligning of the former foster child definition between the state and the federal two definitions. This is because our office works with former foster kids. We have a group called the Oregon Foster Youth Connections, which many of you have probably met with over the last couple weeks when they had their lobby day. And so we receive a lot of phone calls about the confusion that exists regarding the difference between Chaffee and the tuition waiver. And it's already difficult enough for these children to transition out of foster care into independence and trying to figure out how to attend higher ed, but then adding this level of complexity of trying to figure out how they're going to fit into a state definition and a federal definition, and which ones, where each one falls, is definitely confusing. It's not just the children that are calling or the youth that are calling, it's also the adults that are working with them. We passed the bill last session in order to try to eliminate barriers to higher education, and unfortunately, because of these two definitions, we've created another barrier, a difficulty in being able to get the tuition waiver. So we're very, very supportive of this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Reagan. Any questions? Okay, thank you. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2095, and I'm going to open up a work session. Colleagues, normally, as you know, my process is to do a work session several days after we've heard a bill. This seems to be, you can be excused, but this seems to be a no-brainer. All it does is make the definition the same as the federal definition, so I think I'd like to have a work session unless anybody has a problem with that. Okay, so Representative Gomberg?
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I move that House Bill 2095 go to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gomberg moves House Bill 2095 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Any? Sure.
Yes.
Just a quick question. I mean, I see this pop up so frequently. I just want to make sure I understand the need for an emergency clause on this particular bill. I don't know what the effect would be.
It would come effect right now instead of in January 1st of 2020.
Well, I understand, of course, the process. Thank you. Right. I guess I meant I don't know how many people this would affect moving the process up that quickly.
Well, I don't know either. We could call them back if that would be helpful. I would assume there would be people who would be eligible who are out of the process if we don't pass this. Is that accurate? Anybody? Go ahead, Peggy.
I should have asked that sooner, but
no problem.
As we estimate that right now we may have, my name again is Peggy Cooksey, thank you. Representative Gomberg, Chair Tomei and committee, we estimate that there are probably about 40 students right now who may be eligible. Whether they are actually enrolled or will continue to be enrolled for the remainder of the academic year, we won't know until things pan out when we do our final accounting, because they are fluid in their enrollment through the year. But as of the end of fall term, that was what we knew.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 40 kids is good enough for me.
Yes, right. Thank you, Peggy. Okay. So, Representative Gomberg moves House Bill 2095 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. I already said that, didn't I? Any other discussion or questions? Representative Gill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you've covered this, but just for the record, I have not received any information in opposition, and we didn't hear it here.
Right.
So, unless somebody had anything else, I just want to make sure there wasn't anybody in the room or anybody on the panel that had heard anything to the contrary, and that's my comment.
Okay. I haven't heard anything negative. Anybody else? Apparently not. So, Debbie, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Gallegos.
Aye.
Representative Wilcher.
Excused.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Kinney-Geyer.
Aye.
Representative Woodman.
Aye.
Representative Whitson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gomberg.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
The having passed, the motion passes, and who would like to carry this?
I will.
Okay. Representative Kinney-Geyer will carry
Thank
it.
You.
With that, we will close the work session on the 25, and we will close the Human Services and Housing Committee on Monday. Thank you, committee.